You're tuned in with the Underground Christian Network.
Thank you. If you take your Bibles and go to Isaiah chapter 33 with me, please. Isaiah chapter 33. As I do a fair amount of traveling and preaching, some of my sermons are gauged in response to the things I hear people talking about, hear folks concerned about. And a great deal, of course, has been said over the last couple of years about Islam and the circumstance we find ourselves in the world. There's a great deal said in Islamic circles about how American preachers are saying harsh things about Islam. And it's certainly true, American preachers, and myself included, have said some strong things about Islam. We haven't flown any hijacked planes into any of their buildings. We don't train the young people in our theological schools to strap bombs to themselves and go into kindergartens or malls or buses to blow people up. I think on the whole, we've been pretty mild in terms of what we have done. It always interests me that these older leaders bring these young, impressionable men in and teach them to strap bombs to themselves and go out and be martyrs, because it's such a wonderful way to glorify Allah and such a wonderful way to experience paradise. If it were so wonderful, I find myself wondering why some of the teachers don't strap bombs to themselves and go out and be martyrs. But there's a lot of concern among Christian people about what's going on today. And I know this is a very well-informed and very well-educated church on these issues. But I have been sharing a message on this for the last probably year or so, and found a lot of people found it encouraging. And I want to say this. I know this isn't new here, but what I have tried to do a lot in my preaching and writing is take a lot of things together and put them together in their essence in relatively short form. I'd like for you to look with me at Isaiah chapter 33 and verse 18. The passage is about a time when Babylon, Isaiah 33, 18, when Babylon will be besieging Jerusalem. And it makes reference to something there that's instructive for us today. Of course, Babylon is in modern-day Iraq. It's amazing how many important biblical moments took place in modern-day Iraq. And Nebuchadnezzar was the conqueror of what those folks considered the known world, or the world worth conquering. And he was famous for his ability to besiege cities. Matter of fact, 34 different times Nebuchadnezzar set up his armies around the city besieging it, and all 34 times he took the city. He had an absolutely unbroken record. And his tactics for besieging cities were studied and copied clear up to the invention of gunpowder. But one of the things that Nebuchadnezzar did that was different than the folks who'd gone before him, they would besiege a city, and they would look for the weak point in the walls of the city, and they would try to break through at the weakest point of defense and create a gap in the walls. And that would seem sort of logical. But it's not what Nebuchadnezzar did. He would besiege a city, and all the fortified cities of that day would have as a key to their defenses certain towers. And the towers would be strong, and their height would give you the ability to attack the enemy. And he would besiege a city and attack its strongest point with this concept. He said, the issue is when the people lose their will to fight. The issue is when the people are terrorized. And in a city, when the people are terrorized, it doesn't matter if there are 20,000 men fleeing around. Once they're terrorized, they're not fighting you anymore. And the whole concept was to bring down the strongest place in the city, to bring down the most visible place in the city, so that people would see that and their will to resist would crumble. So when Nebuchadnezzar besieged a city, he would go after the strongest towers in the city. And behind that statement, Isaiah 33 and verse 18, thine heart shall meditate terror. Where is the scribe? Where is the receiver? Those were officials of the government. Where is he that counted the towers? That's what's going to happen. The day's going to come because of Nebuchadnezzar. Your people are going to be in absolute terror. You won't know where to find your leaders. They will be in fear. And those that counted the towers, you won't hear from them anymore. What would happen? Nebuchadnezzar one day would besiege Jerusalem, and his armies would attack, and they'd do the various things they did, but they'd get up the next morning and a government official would come out and he'd guarantee the people, see, the tower is still up, and that tower is still up, and that tower is still up, and that tower is still up. He said, but one day, when the dawn comes, you won't be able to find the city officials. They won't want to be seen. They won't want to speak to the mass. They won't want to count the towers because the towers are not all in place. That was his tactic, to terrorize the people by bringing down the tower so visibly so that everybody could see it. Don't think for a second that it's coincidental that the terrorists struck two towers, perhaps the most visible place in all the United States of America. They were trying to learn from Nebuchadnezzar's experience, to learn from Nebuchadnezzar's tactic, and accomplish the same thing and inject such fear in the heart of the American people that they could accomplish their agenda, and then with the United States frightened, have the rest of the world frightened. That was the plan to the whole thing. Now, there's a background to all this, and I realize some preachers have been criticized for making harsh statements. Dr. Vines up in Jacksonville said about Muhammad that he was a demon-possessed pedophile. That's a strong statement, of course. But he called him a pedophile because his last wife was a 9-year-old. I don't know what's debatable about that. There's no debate about that historical fact of that. And I know the defense that's given is that that was common in that culture. And it was common in his culture and in his time. That's because pedophilia was common in his culture and in his time. You have to wonder what there was about the heart of a man that felt an attraction to that situation in any culture or any set of circumstances. As far as the other part of his statement, would you go over with me to 1 John chapter 4 for a moment? This will set a lot of this in perspective. 1 John chapter 4, verse 1. Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets are going out into the world. Now here's the warning, that there are a lot of spirits active in this world. Those spirits have a purpose, those spirits have a message, and because of false spirits, the world is full of false prophets. A message of a false spirit has come to a prophet, made a false prophet out of that person. They then take that message to people, maybe a small handful of people, maybe millions of people. People follow that message. They don't know it. They never had contact with a spirit. But the man that first got that message got it from a false spirit. He said, you've got to be careful, John's writing these Christians. He said, you don't believe everything you hear. There are all kinds of people out there with all kinds of stories. You don't believe everything you hear. Try the Spirit. Here's the test. Test. Verse 2, hereby know ye the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesseth that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God. Now, some in the new evangelical crowd have said, see, that's the test of separation. As long as a person believes in the deed of Christ, we can work with them. Don't say anything there about the test of separation with preachers. It's a test of a spirit. When spirits bring revelation to people, one of two things is happening. Either the Holy Spirit is dealing with them, or a demon is dealing with them. Now, very rarely do demons show up and announce that they're demons set from the pit of hell, designed to curse people and damn them and point them to eternity in hell. They just don't act like that. I hate to break this to you, but demons lie. It's hard to get a character reference on a demon. They show up and claim to be all kinds of things. They pretend to be angels. They pretend to be gods. They pretend to be beings from other planets, which will explain a lot of what's happening in the world to you today. They claim to be an impersonal, mystical force. They make all kinds of claims, but don't tell people the truth. Well, this is the test. And by the way, verse 3, every spirit that confesses not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist, whereof you have heard that it should come. And even now, already is it in the world. I mean, he said, that's the test. By the way, this is what you do when you deal with any religion. You don't have to become an authority on the cults to deal with the cults. There's one simple question. Where does the information come from that your religion, that your movement was founded upon? Where does the information come from? And it'll come from a spirit of some kind. And the next question is, what did that spirit teach about the Lord Jesus? You'll find that over and over again. Some years ago, up in rural Indiana, some religious group had come in. They bought a house right across from public high school, set up a teen center. They were inviting the young people in after classes, and they were teaching them a number of unusual things. And one of the local pastors said, I think this is a New Age movement group. And he said, I want to set up a debate at our church. The guys already agreed to come. Would you be willing to come and debate him? So I said, okay, and I studied the New Age movement, knew some of the main names, and got my points that I wanted to make, and got there, and turned out this particular group had absolutely nothing to do with the New Age movement. We're about to start a debate with an auditorium that would hold about 200 people, jam-packed, and I had never heard of this group before and did not have a clue what they believed. I confess to being a touch nervous about that as we were sitting there. And as one of those things with a debate where he got 3 minutes, I got 3 minutes, he gets 3 minutes, I get 3 minutes. He got a little 3 minutes and talked about things. I said, I just got up and said, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to give you some of my time. I'm going to ask you to help me. Tell me, where did your movement come from? What started it? Where did your information come from? And interestingly enough, he didn't want to answer that question. So I just kept hammering on that. I said, I don't really have anything to say until we know where your movement came from. So finally he told me. It was a group called the Faithists. They had a book they called OWASHBE, the New Bible. Never, I don't think, a large group. I've never come across them any other occasion. But Adam said, well, back in the 1800s, there was a man named John Newborough. And he was very frustrated with organized religion, but he was searching for the truth. And one day he was sitting in his living room reading when an angel came and took over him. And that angel led him to the typewriter and then began to type through his fingers. And he typed out this new revelation, this new Bible, OWASHBE. Which, by the way, among, it was over 1,000 pages. Among the many, many things that it said, taught that Jesus was just one of the higher order of angels who visited this earth temporarily to be an example to people and to provoke people to do right. I said, well, sir, one of two things happened. Either this angel appeared to this man and typed through his fingers, or a demon showed up and lied to him. Now, I said, I'd like for you to explain to me how you know that wasn't a demon. And he started talking about all, you know, they promised. I had a little bit of fun with that with a crowd of teenagers there. I mean, you can trace the false religions of this world one after another that way. Mormonism starts when Joseph Smith, teenager, decides he doesn't like any of the organized churches, and he's walking in the woods one day, and by his own account, two bright lights appear to him, and then he finds out that they're spirits, and they speak to him, and they tell him the earth has not had the truth taught on it since the first century, but God had finally found someone sincere enough to reveal the truth to and bring the world back to the truth. That must be pretty impressive to be the most sincere person in several hundred years. And Joseph Smith decided God made a pretty good choice. And they gave him what became the Book of Mormon. Now, those were either demons or they were angels. But by the way, they told him, yes, that Jesus is God, but in the same way that all of us can become God. I mean, you can go on and on. Charles Taz Russell, founder of Jehovah's Witnesses, was a Sunday school teacher in a Protestant church, but he began to get this idea there was no hell, and he began to teach it in the adult Sunday school class, and the deacons called him in and said, you can't teach that here. This is not what we believe. It's not what's in the Bible. He got angry and left, and he said he didn't know what to do, and he said the voice of God spoke to him. He could hear it audibly with his ears. He said a voice of God told him that the truth hadn't been on the earth since the apostles. But God had finally found someone who sought for the truth so much that he could be used to bring it back to the world. And for some strange reason, Charles Taz Russell was willing to believe he was the greatest truth seeker in several hundred years. They started the Jehovah's Witness movement. Not too long ago, a crazy group started called The Way. At least admit that they're upfront about what they believe. Their first doctrinal book is entitled Jesus is Not God. It's the first book you study when you go to their church. A lot of people surprised to find out the fellow that started that went to and graduated from a fundamental Bible college. Was pastoring a fundamental church. And he said one day he was sitting in his study and he heard a voice. Audibly. Could hear it just like you'd hear you or I. And a voice began to explain to him that he was wasting his time there pastoring that church. That church didn't have the truth. That the truth had not been seen or heard on the earth for centuries. But God had finally found someone who could be trusted to bring the truth back to the earth, and it was him. And so the voice began to teach him the truth, and the very first truth the voice taught him was that Jesus was not God. This last week we had a little reminder of it, but we had to get rid of a couple of the young men in our Bible college early in the school year. They got themselves involved with a diabolically false cult that teaches salvation by works. One of them or somebody from their groups dropped off a bunch of information unsolicited, I guess earlier in the week. One of the young men came to see me afterwards. November, December or so, and we sat down and talked, and he said, well, I can tell you how I know what we're doing is true and it's of God. I said, well, please tell me. He said, I was sitting in my dorm room, and he said, I know before I tell you this, you're going to tell me it was a demon. And when I said, I was sitting in my dorm room, and a spirit appeared to me, and he said, it had to be an angel. And this spirit began to tell him the danger of telling people that you could be saved solely by trusting in what Jesus Christ did on the cross of Calvary for you. And that spirit then began to enlighten him that we are saved by our faith and our works after our faith. And I let him tell me the story. It was fairly interesting. I said, you know, I have discovered something you and I both agree on. I am going to tell you it was a demon. It's a message demons. Always has been. I don't care what you believe as long as you miss the gospel. Muhammad, 1,400 years ago in Arabia, in a time when many of the pagan Arabian tribes were being won to Christ, genuinely, our four Baptist forefathers, the Paulicians, were there. They were winning people to Christ. They were calling people out of the paganism. They were calling them to trust one God. They were spreading the scriptures with them. Muhammad shows a great knowledge of Jesus, mentions him 27 times in the Quran, quotes verses from the New Testament. They were spreading the scriptures around Arabia. They were winning people to Christ. Muhammad himself refers to having known them. In fact, he called them in the Quran Sabians, immersers. He said there's three groups active there, the Roman Catholics, the Jews, and the immersers. In other words, the Baptists. He understood all that. Well, he married a rich widow, and he was shown a caravan. He was responsible for taking the caravan back and forth. There was a certain oasis they would stop at, and there in that oasis was a little cave, and he was staying in the cave. And he said spirits began to come to him. And at first he resisted them and told them to go away. He believed, based on what the Paulicians had told him, those spirits were demons. He even went back after the first trip and told his wife that these demons were trying to bother him. And his wife said, well, maybe they're not demons. Maybe they're really angels. And by his own account, they kept coming to him and telling him how wonderful he was and the truth seeker that he was. And the earth didn't have the truth. And God was looking for someone to be his one chosen prophet. And he was the man. And after a while, they convinced him. That's why they're called in 1 Timothy 4, seducing spirits. They kept working on him. By the way, since the 1980s, 20 years, there's been a man in Europe in hiding named Salman Rushdie. He wrote a book about Muhammad's experiences, and he called it The Satanic Verses. And he just simply said that when Muhammad first began to put this communication down, Muhammad was still afraid it was from a demon. And so he began to ponder, what if Muhammad was right and those verses really are from Satan? And when he did, some of the religious leaders in Iran and other Muslim countries put out a warrant for his death. And he's had to live in hiding ever since. Well, I'm going to tell you something. He was on target. Not because it was Muhammad or not because they were Arabs. I don't care if you're a white kid at Landmark Baptist College and a spirit appears to you and gives you a message contrary to the scriptures. He's a demon and it's from the devil. Well, when Muhammad began to put these teachings together, of course the spirits taught him salvation by works. But there's a unique thing about Islam that helps to make it popular. Many religions that teach salvation by works have hundreds or thousands of works that you must do to be saved. You can't even remember them all. I wouldn't even try if I was confronted with all that. I'd just give up. But Islam's interesting. You only have to do 5 works to go to heaven. Now, I can remember 5 things. You only have to do 5 works. You just simply have to believe in one God. You have to have daily prayers. And over the years, they developed the idea 5 times and so forth, have to look towards Mecca. You have to make a pilgrimage to Mecca once a year. Just in case you ladies were worried about how hard that would be, you don't have to go. But of course, there's a reason for that. That's because salvation is not for you. Salvation is for men. You're not under the same level of pressure. You have a place in eternity, but it's not exactly the same. And fourthly, it's presented today as you need to give alms to your fellow Muslims, help the poor. Now that sounds okay. But the truth is, that wasn't the original concept of the teaching of it. The original concept was that you were to stand with your fellow Muslims no matter what the situation or the circumstances were. And when you understand that, you'll understand why all over this planet, even the Muslims who would not participate in anything like the terror attacks, can't bring themselves to criticize those that do. You're supposed to have a loyalty to Muslims above your loyalty to all of the people, even when your other Muslims are wrong. And then there's another one. It's called Jihad, the Holy War. Now, it's very often presented by those who want to put Islam in a good light today that the Holy War is a war of self-defense that you fight against all those folks who are trying to destroy Islam. But if you read the Quran, by self-defense, they mean self-defense against anybody who doesn't practice Islam. That is why they would call the attack on the Twin Towers self-defense. That is why every time a suicide bomber walks into an Israeli kindergarten to blow up as many 5-year-olds as they can, they say that was done in self-defense. That is why when they demand religious freedom for Islam in the United States, but won't grant religious freedom to Christianity in any of the countries they control, they just call that self-defense. They've carried that a considerable way. Get a hold of something. The concept of jihad is not what you and I think of as a defensive war. The concept of jihad is the conquest of the world by force, which they have been engaged in ever since Islam was started. They took Mecca and Medina by force. They took Arabia by force. They took the Mideast by force. They took North Africa by force. Matter of fact, you hear them talk a great deal about how evil the Crusades were, because they said the Crusaders came and tried to take the Mideast from Islam by force. Ask you a question. How did Islam get to Mideast? I'm not defending everything that was done in the name of the Crusaders. And by the way, that wasn't Bible Christianity behind those Crusades. It was Catholic Christianity behind those Crusades. And they didn't believe in salvation by faith either. And they committed some atrocities along the way. I don't have any doubt about that. But they were committing atrocities to try and rescue that region from folks who were committing even worse ones. As a matter of fact, you'd be hard-pressed to find a square inch of territory that Islam controls that they did not take by force, by sword, by violence. Matter of fact, they've been very devoted to taking Europe. They tried to invade Europe and took Spain and held on to Spain for a long time. They got stopped as they left Spain. They tried to go into France, and the border between France and Spain was particularly protected by this tower that was the heart of the French defense, and they tried to copy Nebuchadnezzar by bringing down the strongest place, but Charles Martel led the French people there. They came to call him Charles the Hammer, and the battle was remembered as the Battle of the Tours, the Battle of the Tower. And the French fought and fought and fought and stopped Islam from sweeping through Europe. Different people in that day, the French. In the 1500s, Islam calculated they could take Europe by invading its soft underbelly, what they call the southern part of France. And to do that, they needed to have as a staging base the island of Malta. Not a big island, not a big population. There are about 1,000 soldiers stationed there and another 9,000 adult males. And 80,000 Muslim soldiers landed on that little series of three islands. The people there came together and had a sense of how historic their mission was. They realized that they were defending all of Europe and thus the future of the world. And the men took a vow that they would fight to the death to prevent Islam from getting that staging base. They eventually received about 1,200 reinforcements in what would come to be called the Great Siege. And by the way, for a long time, history books recorded this as one of the most significant events in history. But for some reason, it's almost dropped out of all the world history books over the last 25 years. Amazing. For months, they withstood overwhelming odds, a little over 11,000 men, over 10,000 of them died in the defense of Malta. They used catapults a lot in those days. When they ran out of the prepared stones for the catapults, they began to cut the heads off the dead Muslim soldiers and fire the heads back at them. Night after night, they went to the walls with a huge number of them being killed. But they took a vow to fight to the death rather than to see Islam take over Europe and make slaves of the European people. By the way, meditate a little bit what it would have been like if they hadn't. If Islam had swept over Europe, there would have been no Christian communities to have come and start the greatest beacon that freedom's ever known in this world, the United States of America. They finally, after killing over half of the Muslim army, withdrew, and they successfully defended Malta. In the 1600s, Islam tried to go through Eastern Europe. They swept through Eastern Europe, controlled it for a while till they got to Vienna. In the 1600s, they besieged the city of Vienna for several months. But again, in Vienna, nations that normally didn't work with Austria. In fact, Vienna was Catholic, but many of the Protestant nations said, look, our whole future is at stake. If Islam, our problems with Catholicism are bad enough, but if Islam takes Europe, there'll be no freedom for any of us. There'll be no opportunity for any of us. And Protestant armies went to defend that Catholic city. And they fought there for months, finally defeating the Muslims. But as they withdrew, they held on to cities and sections of Eastern Europe, which, by the way, is the background of all the fighting in Serbia, Kosovo, Montenegro, and Yugoslavia today, is fighting between the Christian communities there and the Muslim communities. I do not defend everything the Christian communities have done there, by the way, but it's interesting to me when the United States got involved in that fight in the 1990s, we got involved in that fight on the side of the Muslim communities. I have a hard time explaining that. At least I wish I had a hard time explaining. The first war the United States ever fought, and the second war we ever fought that was declared war as a nation, were fought against the Barbary Pirates. Those were the North African Muslim states that sent out ships to raid European and American, what they called Christian ships. They taught that it was consistent with their religion to take any Christian ship. They would take it, take the property. They would take the people and hold them for ransom. A few, most of them were sold as slaves. Now it was considered part of their religion. It was considered acceptable. They demanded that the European nations pay them ransom to not attack their, pay them bribes rather, not to attack their ships. That's when an American foreign minister made the famous statement that would then be echoed by the president, millions for defense. Not a penny for tribute. And we built a navy. Didn't even have one. People laughed and called it the Mosquito Fleet. But we sent it to North Africa and brought the palaces of a couple of sultans. Let them palaces come tumbling down around them. And the Barbary Pirates sued for peace. Most of the European nations were paying bribes. A few years later, they began to think with a new presidential administration they could operate differently. And we had the second Barbary Coast War. And we had to teach them the same lesson again. And by the way, a lot of folks have forgotten this. In World War I, we didn't just fight the Germans and the Italians. We fought the Germans, the Italians, and the Ottoman Empire. That was the empire that controlled most of Islam, that had as its goal the conquest of the world for Islam. They were our enemy in World War I. We fought them in the battlefield, and we defeated them. Along with the European nations, after World War I, we said something must be done about Islam. It cannot be allowed to remain as this world power. So we broke Islam up into small nations, hoping to use those nations to check one another and keep one another from being powerful. We did it along natural geographic boundaries, paying no attention to the natural groupings of the people. So we created Kuwait, we created Iraq, we created Iran, we created all the countries in the Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabia and Yemen and South Yemen and Qatar and all those places. We just went through the map and said, we'll divide them up this way. We didn't really care how much they got divided up. We just didn't want it to be one power. Because if there's one power, it would have to be defeated in a world war again. And so we broke it up into nations, hoping to keep those nations small and powerless. Because of that, for over 60 years, Islam was not much of a threat, and the world went to sleep thinking it had changed. Hadn't changed, it was powerless. It was powerless because it lost in World War I, and because they lost, we took away their power. That's the way things have normally worked in wars throughout the history of the world. And even to this day, the thing that keeps Islam from being more deadly than it is now is because all these nations have trouble working together. Two forces arose within Islam to do something about this. One, all kinds of groups, most famous of them, of course, is bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. They said, we may not be able to create a military power that will conquer the world, but we'll terrorize the world into submission. Then there was Saddam Hussein, who had the idea that he would create a new Ottoman Empire, a new Babylon. He considered himself the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar and also the reincarnation of some of the leaders of the Ottoman Empire. He said, I'll conquer Arabia. That'll give me control of 50% of the world's oil. I'll develop nuclear weapons, which will make me a nuclear power, and I'll be able to go toe-to-toe with the Soviet Union and the United States. Y'all know how that story went. He set out to conquer Kuwait. It was next door. It was powerless. As a first step to conquering Arabia, he went into Kuwait and then ran into a surprise as the United States and first President Bush said, this will not stand. Put together a coalition. And then Saddam Hussein, and I remember wondering at the time if God would use that experience to judge the United States. We have some grounds for being judged. But I heard Saddam Hussein say, back when he was holding all the hostages and we were putting together the coalition against him, that the coming battle would be the mother of all battles. You remember that famous comment? But he said in the same interview that this battle would prove to the world who was God, Allah or Jehovah. And when he said that, I said, that man is in trouble. If you're going to make those the stakes and that the issue, he's in trouble. And you all know what happened with the first Gulf War. By the way, there's incredible stories to that. Our great fear in the first Gulf War was the poison gas that Saddam Hussein had. There wasn't much debate about it. He'd used it against the Iranians and against the Kurds. It's pretty hard to debate whether or not he had it. And we are concerned about the poison gas, and we're concerned about the landmines, but we've taken all the precautions we could, and folks were hoping that our casualties would only be a few thousand. But our armies began to move, and the day they moved, powerful winds came and uncovered almost all of the landmines. And the wind blew back in the face of the Iraqi army and made it impossible for them to release their poison gas. Could, of course, just be coincidence. Or it could be there were a lot of folks in America praying, in England and other places. Or it could just be God had said, if you really want this battle to show who God is, we'll let it. We made a horrible mistake. We let the United Nations tell us that Saddam and Islam was not the threat, that the only thing we could do was move them out of Kuwait. And we left him in place. Boy, that didn't sound like the Allies after World War I. They knew Islam was the threat. They were as sure that Islam was the threat as we were that the Nazis were a threat at the end of World War II. But not anymore. We've become so multicultural, saying that all religions are the same and all philosophies are the same and all beliefs are the same, that we have totally disarmed ourselves morally and spiritually as a nation for fighting this kind of battle and this being in this kind of war. We can't bring ourselves to say anything's wrong. If you have any doubt about that, look where we are in the homosexual marriage issue. Our most conservative politicians don't want to have to take a public stand on this. We brought ourselves to the place we can't condemn anything, that we apologize for being opposed to anything, except, of course, extremist Christianity. Bin Laden and many others like him said about the influence, the decisions of nations through terrorism. They got off to an incredible start attacking Israel, attacking various European nations, attacking the United States. But the fact was, they have a big problem, and Bin Laden recognized it. They've announced to the world for 40 years their intention to destroy Israel and kill every Jew. Isn't it amazing? Every few days they make the same announcement, now we're going to war against Israel. Boy, is that new. But they've never been able to destroy Israel. And there's one reason they can't. Israel has American military equipment. In the 73 war, one American-made tank driven by an Israeli took out 80 Jordanian tanks that they had purchased from the Soviet Union. Now, the way they did that, the American-made tank had a 3-mile firing range, and the Russian-made tanks had a 1-mile firing range, and he just stayed 2 miles away from them the whole time. So yeah, that is the, and it's illustrated in aircraft and computers and everything. That is the reason the 30 Arab nations who are committed to destroy Israel can't overwhelm Israel. It has American military equipment. Not only that, America finances the missions of the world. We send out many of the missionaries, and over the last 10 years, we've become the financiers for the missions coming out of other countries, like Korea and the Philippines. And wherever we get a chance to get the gospel to the Muslim people, a bundle of them get saved. And the terrorists look at the United States. They call us the great Satan. They call Israel the little Satan, but they call us the great Satan. We make Israel possible, and we make missions possible. and they see the United States as the one thing that is preventing them from terrorizing the world into submission. By the way, if you've listened to the speeches that have been made the last 2.5 years, I sort of think they might be right about that. That if it wasn't for the United States, the rest of the world would meekly cave in. Matter of fact, if you'll listen, I'd say if it weren't for about half of the United States, the world would meekly cave in. Not enough folks in this country ready to meekly cave in. But the fact is, we need to come to grips with some things. We're in a world war. We did not declare it. We didn't start it. We didn't want it. It's not part of our agenda. And we have no potential profit from it unless you want to call survival profit. But we didn't start World War I, and we didn't start World War II. And by the way, I think of this as the Fourth World War. The Third World War was the war with communism. We didn't start that either. And for a long time, we weren't willing to deal with it effectively enough to have a chance at winning it. Praise God for Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, who came along and changed that. Both tying their opposition to communism to the Christian heritage of the nations that they were the leaders of. And doing it publicly and openly and unashamedly. And they sent communism to the dustbin of history. But you understand, Islam's a different kind of war. The fact is, you could defeat bin Laden and all the leading terrorist leaders in the world today. You could take them all out, and you'd still have another generation of young Islamic men reading the Quran, inspired to the same thing. This isn't a war that's going to go away in a year, or 5 years, or 10 years, or in our lifetime. I will be surprised if it goes away before the return of the Lord Jesus, whenever that's going to be. We have to come to grips with some things. In times past in this country, when America was in war, Christians felt like they had a special responsibility. We prayed. We got on a war footing, if you will. We were praying for our troops. We considered that a high priority. We were praying for our country. We were praying for our national leadership. We saw things in terms of a battle of good versus evil. And very frankly, even Franklin Delano Roosevelt did not hesitate to call World War II a battle between Christianity and paganism. And it was, by the way, a battle between Christianity and paganism. The Queen of England never hesitated in those days to go on the radio and ask people to pray for victory. But our world's become so multicultural. Not just our political leaders, but many of our so-called evangelical leaders would be embarrassed to speak in those terms. And I got to tell you, it frightens me. In our best, soundest, most fundamental Baptist churches, we act like nothing's going on. But we're in a war. We're not against a war against the individual Muslim. What we'd love to do is win those people to Christ. And when it happens, we're thrilled for them. And I have had the privilege, we've had some in our church, well, I've had the privilege of meeting over the last few years a number of Muslims, people of Muslim background or from Muslim countries who found Christ as their Savior and could rejoice in the joy and the freedom that it brought them. Got to read in books the testimonies of others that came to Christ and realized what was wrong with all the hatred that they were taught and have come forward and been honest about what the agenda was. We rejoice in that, but we need to come to grips with some things. We need to start thinking like we were in a war. And we need to start remembering, just like World War I and just like World War II, the biggest issues are not political, military, or economic. They're spiritual. We need a revival in this country, and we need it badly. We need a sense of priorities as Christian people, and we need them badly. We need a commitment to missions and influencing the world with the gospel that goes far beyond anything that we've ever known in the past, because ultimately that's the great issue. In the mid-1800s, the whole Mideast was open to the gospel and to missionaries. After World War I, it was all open to the gospel and missionaries again, because when the European nations and the United States divided up all this area into different countries, when those, in those early days, we put all kinds of pressure on them about how they could behave, and the doors were open for the missionaries from about the around 1920 to the 1950s. They weren't brave enough to stop missions for close to a 30-year period. And we sent only a handful. And we're sure paying for it today. Wonder what would happen if we had flooded those regions when we could have. With preachers of the gospel. With church builders. With folks to build Christian schools so young Palestinian children could have been trained in Christian schools rather than the madras where they're taught in kindergarten that the greatest thing that can ever happen to them is to be a suicide bomber. Wonder what would happen if we'd taken the opportunities that God had given us. That story can't be rewritten. Well, we sure do get to decide what we're going to do about missions now. What we're going to do about getting the gospel everywhere that we can get it. We get to decide now. But the fact is, we're so comfortable. We're so calm. We're so relaxed about it all. This is going to be the first war that was ever fought and won or maybe lost while the people of that country weren't even paying attention to the fact that it was going on. I don't think it gets as much coverage as sports. And by the way, I understand there's all sorts of legitimate room for debate over tactics and policy. But in World War II, there were not Republicans and Democrats when it came to the war effort. Folks might have fussed at how the president handled certain details. And he might have fussed about what level of support he got from Republicans in Congress. And all that has its place. We're human beings. But we were one nation at war with those that attacked us. And even the most bitter critics of the president rallied around him as a war leader. I mean, we as a nation desperately need to come to grips with some things. But let me tell you something. There's not a chance in the world of a nation ever coming to grips with it if God's people don't lead the way. We need to get a sense of seriousness about this. And we need a sense of prayer. And we need a sense of priorities about revival. And we need a sense of commitment to missions. Yes, it's being obedient to God's command, but if you take the whole spiritual realm out of it, our whole future, our survival is at stake with how we get the gospel to the rest of the world. Where are those that counted the towers? We have a couple fewer towers to count in this country now. It was designed to terrorize us into submission. And that did not work, by the way. There was an initial reaction. Rather than being terrorized into submission, for a few brief moments, America reacted the way that it has in the past and the way that it ought to. And rather than being terrorized into submission, all of a sudden those folks begin to hide in their holes and in their caves to survive. But we didn't have the spiritual depth to maintain that. And it isn't going to come back unless God's people get a sense of spiritual purpose. Unless God's people get a sense of revival. Dear Heavenly Father, accomplish your purpose with this. This is what I felt like you laid in my heart. Use it to accomplish your purpose in among the folks that are here. Honor and glorify yourself in Jesus' name.
You're tuned in with the Underground Christian Network.